Bear, on the Super Symmetry, the third part, Dark Matter.
Okay, let's see. Today I'm going to talk about dark matter and give a theory and somewhat of a little bit of an experimental overview as well. Talking about evidence for cold dark matter, candidates for cold dark matter. I'll focus mainly on neutrinos in minimal supergravity model and going beyond minimal supergravity. And this is a picture of dark matter particles getting produced at the at a linear collider. Dark matter particles go up the dark side here. So these are the visible guys. This is actually a Chargino pair event where one Chargino is decayed to EQ bar plus a neutralino, and these are the two jets. The other Chargino decayed to an electron and made a depth deposit in the electromagnetic calorimetry. And then you can see the apparent momentum imbalance over here on this side. So first of all, evidence for dark matter. The first evidence was already noted back in the 1930s by Fritz Zwicky, because he saw lots of clusters of galaxies that all seemed to be somehow gravitated into a cluster, and given their velocities, he thought that they should have been flying freely and they wouldn't have binding. So he conjectured already way back in the 1930s that maybe there was some extra dark matter hanging around these galactic clusters to help gravitate them and hold them together. The most direct evidence comes from galactic rotation curves, of which one example is up here. This is the velocity of different stars as a function of their distance out from the galactic center. And many of these, this is for a particular galaxy called NGC 6503. Many galaxies have a similar structure, but when you look at the stars as you get far out away from the galactic center, their velocity distribution just levels off to a constant. Whereas if you had used Newton's law and added up all the stars in the middle, then you would expect there to be lots of stars in the middle. As you go further out in the galaxy, you encompass fewer and fewer stars within a sphere, and you'd expect that the velocity distribution would be ultimately falling due to going further and further out. If you add in extra galactic gas, you get another contribution this much to the rotation curve, which is not enough to match up with this data. So instead, people conjecture there must be some sort of a halo distribution that ultimately dominates the gravitation in a galaxy and causes these curves to level off at large distances from galactic centers. There's also evidence from gravitational lensing, namely if you got one galaxy in front of another one, sometimes you can see a lens formation, which would only occur if you've got enough gravity in the intervening galaxy to bend the light sufficiently. Lately, since WMAP began operating and collecting data, we now see in the imprinted on the cosmic microwave background imprints of dark matter and dark energy. Because the in the Big Bang, when there were fluctuations in the temperature in the early universe, if there was dark matter around that could ultimately collect in the over-dense regions, it would cause these things to give extra gravitation. Finally, there's also evidence from simulations of large-scale structure in the universe. If you want to simulate how galaxies came to be and how they collected and match it up with data. It's very hard. You cannot match the observed large-scale structure, the pattern of voids and over-dense regions, unless you have some form of cold dark matter. As a matter of fact, that's one of the evidences that hot dark matter doesn't make up the bulk of the dark matter in the universe, because that wouldn't give you enough, would be streaming too much and wouldn't give you enough gravity to quite localize to make galaxies the structure that we observe. So out of all this data, especially the WMAP data, what has emerged in recent years is what's called the concordance model, or what's now the standard cosmological model, which is the lambda cold dark matter model, and that posits that the that finds that the universe is made up of with a density matter and energy density equal to the critical closure density with very small error bars. So it's consistent with an inflationary universe, which predicts omega equal to 1. And then if you look at the amount of baryons in the universe, Big Bang nucleosynthesis plus CMB spectra tell you that omega times the scaled Hubble constant, this h here is around 0.7, so h squared is around 0.1 half. This is around 0.023, or the baryonic matter makes up about 5% of the matter of the universe. Neutrinos make up a very tiny fraction of the dark matter of the universe. Their omega h squared is less than 0.0076. And surprise was that a cosmological constant or some form of dark energy makes up the bulk of the energy budget, omega h squared around 0.35. And then there has to be some form of cold dark matter, a neutral, heavy, weakly interacting particle that has omega h squared around 0.113, which makes up about 20-25% of the matter and energy budget of the universe. So this is very exciting because nobody knows what the dark energy or the dark matter is. This is the plot I actually showed earlier of the vacuum energy density and the mass density of the universe. And you can see data from cluster formation, data from search for supernovae and distant galaxies, and the CMB all converge at this one spot here, which pins down the dark matter and the dark energy to be around 25%, 70% of the energy budget of the universe, respectively. Okay, well, this is a school on particle physics, and dark matter seems likely to be an elementary particle of some sort, and there's many candidates in physics that could make up the dark matter. One candidate which seems rather obvious that could occur in the standard model would be some form of unseen baryons. For instance, you could have extra galactic gas, or these baryons could collect into black holes or brown dwarfs or huge planets, Jupiters that you can't see. But that would be inconsistent with the Big Bang nucleosynthesis calculations, which find you actually have to have only 5% of the energy budget in nucleon. And furthermore, there have been a lot of searches from experiments like Macho, Eros, and Vogel. These are experiments that look at nearby satellite galaxies like the Magellanic Clouds, and then they watch over millions of stars and see if there are any black holes or brown dwarfs that move in front of these stars and cause an eclipsing effect, so you get a fluctuation in the light output from these stars. Well, hardly any events are seen, which means that there can't be lots and lots of black holes floating around that would be eclipsing these stars. And so it looks like unseen baryons cannot make up the dark matter of the universe. neutrinos are so light nowadays, we know that they have to be quite light. And so they would have to necessarily make up hot dark matter, but structure formation, as I said, needs cold dark matter. Another possible candidate are axions. Axions are associated with the Petche Quinn solution to the strong CP problem, and they could be a viable dark matter candidate. There's also another class called WIMPs, which stands for weakly interacting massive particles, and these occur in a variety of physical theories. In supersymmetry with R parity conservation, the light of supersymmetric particles got to be absolutely stable, and it's usually neutral, and so that could make up the dark matter. In models with universal extra dimensions, these are models where you take the standard model and embed it in, say, a five-dimensional universe where all the particles propagate in the extra five dimensions, and then you compactify the extra dimension, then you get Kaluza-Klein excitations, and you can get, if you've got a conserved Kaluza-Klein parity, you could get either the partner of the B mu boson, the n equal 1 kk level of that particle can be the dark matter, or the partner of the graviton could be the dark matter. Little Higgs models have a lightest e-odd particle. Other extra-dimensional models have brainons. There are some things called WIMPzillas, which have been described in, by Rocky Cole. Ruskowski puts a lot of these all on one plot here. Here's the log of the mass of the WIMP candidate and the log of its interaction cross-section divided by one picobar. Neutralinos are over here, neutrinos are here. WIMPzillas are at extremely high masses. Gravitinos can span a large mass range but would have a very tiny interaction cross-section. And then there's axions and possibly the supersymmetric partner of the axion called the axino. So there's many possibilities in the literature to make up cold dark matter. One particularly interesting candidate is the axion. Remember, the QCD Lagrangian has a part that you're normally familiar with that gives rise to a lot of the collider phenomenology. But then there's the part containing FF dual, which is CP violating, and limits from the neutron electric dipole moment say that that term's got to be exceedingly small. So you have to explain why that term is exceedingly small, and Petche Quinn came up with a symmetry that does the job, but part of the symmetry ultimately gets broken and leaves a pseudo-Goldstone boson called the axion at a scale associated with the axion called F sub A. So these axions get, in the early universe, would get produced non-thermally via vacuum misalignment mechanism. And when they get produced, they can have a relic density that could be within the range of what is measured. Now, the mass of the axion is given by lambda QCD squared over F sub A. And this can range over a rather broad range, 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the 2 electron volts. You can actually calculate the relic density in this vacuum misalignment mechanism. And it turns out this is proportional to F sub A. So it's inversely proportional to the mass of the axion. And there's a few other constants in here which are probably of order 1. And the whole thing will give you a relative density around ranging from 10 to the minus 8 to 10 to the 2. So that spans many 10 orders of magnitude. And from that point of view, it could be the dark matter. You'd have to be lucky just to get it right at 0.11. So it could be, or there could be what's called mixed dark matter where you get a WIMP, and then this gives you some very tiny component of dark matter. The axions actually couple to electromagnetic fields. There's an A photon-photon coupling, and Sakiti used this to suggest a way to detect these things. If they're floating around through our room right now, then you could build an axion microwave cavity, and as these axions float through the cavity, they cause resonances that you can detect in the microwave cavity, and you can try to pick up the signal from these things. And there's also astrophysical bounds, namely if you've got exploding supernovas or star cooling, they could release axions and cool too fast. So these all give limits on the axion. Here's a sample of some of the constraints from axion searches. There's a variety of astrophysical constraints here. Bottom scale is the axion mass, going from 10 to the minus 6 to 10 to the 2 electron volts. And over here is the axion photon coupling. These lines here, EFSZ and KSVZ, these are two different axion models, and they make a prediction for the mass of the axion versus the coupling. So this is where you think that the axions might lie. And so the upper mass range is restricted by astrophysical bounds. And the microwave cavity experiments are currently probing down here. This one's just touching the very tip of the KSVZ model. It hasn't quite got down to the Dyne-Fischer-Fricke model here. But these are painstaking experiments, and they're ongoing, and people are working on axion searches. But so far, no evidence, no solid evidence has come out for axion. Now moving from axions to WIMPs, supersymmetry, as I explained in the other lectures, has a symmetry between bosons and fermions and gives you a doubling of the spectra of the standard model. You get a plethora of spin zero quarks and leptons, spin one half chargenos, neutralinos, and gluinos, extra Higgses, and if you have R parity conservation, as is natural in grand unified theories, then the lightest Susie particle ought to be stable. So if you look at theories like gravity-mediated models, the lightest neutralino usually becomes an LSP. That's a neutral particle, and that makes a good candidate for dark matter. But there are a whole host of dark matter candidates within supersymmetry itself. Sneutrinos were thought to be a candidate, but if you had relics of neutrinos floating around, they have a rather large interaction cross-section with nuclei, and there's a variety of direct search experiments that have looked for these things, and they pretty much exclude them over most reasonable mass range. So neutrinos seem to be excluded. It could be gravitinos, and these are called super WIMPs because they're super weakly interacting instead of weakly interacting. These things could get produced, and I'll talk about those a little bit later on. Neutralinos I've already mentioned. But in other types of models that are not supergravity, for instance, gauge mediation models, those models have a whole messenger sector that connects what I said was the hidden sector to the visible sector. And there are neutral particles in the messenger sector that could possibly be dark matter particles. Then there could be states associated with hidden sectors. If you add in a hidden sector, you may have fields that would leave some sort of particle there. And then there's the axino or saxion, which would be the super partner of the axion. So there's lots of different candidates. Now it turns out that given all those candidates, there's one that's really preferred, and that is, the preferable theory seems to be theories based on gravity-mediated Susie braking models. In these gravity-mediated Susie braking models, a gravitino picks up a mass, the m, the scale of Susie braking squared over m quant, where ms is around 10 to the 11th GeV. So if this is a TEV scale, then the theory below the gut scale is usually assumed to be the MSSM. And then you can do all this business of running of soft terms and calculate the spectra. Now the main point about these models is that you automatically get the TeV scale particles, and if you go ahead and calculate the relic abundance, the simplest way that you could get a relic particle in the early universe is if somehow that relic particle was in thermal equilibrium early on in the universe. And then if it was in thermal equilibrium, you can actually calculate the relic abundance. And it turns out that to get the relic abundance right, the neutralino has got to have a annihilation cross-section that is of the order of 1 picobarn naturally. And a 1 picobarn cross-section would give you a width mass around 100 GeV, and that's the gravity mediation models naturally give you a thermal WIMP. So these things seem to be preferred. There's other models like gauge mediation models. In those models, typically the gravitino is much, much lighter, and it is the lightest UV particle, and it does not have enough mass to make up the dark matter in the universe. Then there are another class of models called anomaly mediation models. In those models, the lightest SUSY particle is a pure Weno particle. And the pure Weno particles have such a large annihilation cross-section that, again, they have trouble making omega h squared equal to 0.11. And they don't seem to be preferred. But as I said, you can do funny things to those models to mock them up to get the right relic density, like have the messenger sector particles be the dark matter or something like that. But the dark matter with the right properties occurs quite naturally out of the gravity-mediated model. And so that's why most of the emphasis has been on this class of models for supersymmetric particles. Now, if you look at the gravity-mediated models, there's a whole variety of constraints on these things. LEP 2 has got a bunch of search limits on the mass of the Higgs, the mass of the Chardino, the mass of the Selectron. These would all be bigger than about 100 GeV. There's constraints from B to S gamma. These rare B decays could be mediated by SUSY particles. And the branching fraction for B to S gamma is measured to be about 3 times 10 to minus 4, and the standard model also predicts it to be right in that same vicinity, so any SUSY particle contribution has got to somehow decouple or cancel out of that branching fraction. The G minus 2 of the muon is measured to have a 2.6 sigma deviation from theory, and you can't explain that in supersymmetry. And finally, there's a B to mu mu constraint, which is effective at extremely large tan beta. The biggest constraint nowadays on supergravity models is this WMAP constraint that the cold dark matter should be equal to 0.113 plus or minus 0.009. This number has been slightly updated from WMAP 3, but it doesn't really affect any of the conclusions here. And the important point is that the dark matter could completely saturate this bound here, the neutralino could, or there could have mixed dark matter. Maybe the neutralinos make up half of this and axions make up half. It mainly has to be less than or equal to that bound. Now, if you have neutralino dark matter, then the intriguing thing is that it interacts weakly, and so if you have a hot Big Bang model, it should have been in thermal equilibrium with the cosmic soup at very early times. And as the universe would expand and cool, Then the thermal, the cosmic soup would also cool. And these neutrinos in thermal equilibrium, they're annihilating with one another to make standard model particles or other 2D particles. And then they're also getting created out of the annihilation of standard model particles in the cosmic soup. As the universe expands and cools, at some point there's not enough energy in the cosmic soup to make the neutrinos, but they can still annihilate away. So you can actually calculate their number density from the Boltzmann equation of statistical mechanics. And the number density, dn by dt, as a function of time, is given by one factor that depends on the Hubble expansion, got the Hubble concentration there, and another term that depends on the neutralino annihilation rate times the relative velocity that is thermally averaged. And the important point here is that if you solve this equation, the relative abundance today depends crucially on this thermally averaged annihilation prospect of time's velocity. So there's turns out there's many thousands of Feynman diagrams that these neutralinos can annihilate by. They can annihilate, or they could co-annihilate. If you've got another supersymmetric particle close in mass, then that one could also be in the cosmic soup, and it could annihilate against the neutralino and get rid of them that way. So you've got both annihilation and co-annihilation. And then there's many computer codes. Newt drivers no longer maintained. Dark SUSY is publicly available. Of the relative density. Micromegas is by a French group. ISARED is a part of ISAJET. And then there's a number of private codes by different groups, which are not public release ones, all listed here. And this is just a picture of what the dark matter number density looks like versus time evolution in the early universe. Bottom scale is inverse temperature, which is basically the same as time. And this is the co-moving number density. Up here along this curve, the neutralinos would be in thermal equilibrium. And if they stayed in thermal equilibrium and the temperature decreased, then they would have an extremely tiny relative abundance. But since they freeze out at some point, instead a relic density gets locked in at some level. Now here you see this sign says increasing annihilation cross-section means as this annihilation rate gets down, then the freeze-out time occurs later and later, and you get a lower and lower relic abundance. So that's sort of a visual solution of that Boltzmann. Now, if the particle, dark matter particle, was a neutralino, here's a few of the mechanisms by which they can annihilate away in the early universe. You could have something called bulk annihilation, where two neutralinos come in, they annihilate to an E plus E minus pair via electron exchange in the P channel. And these electrons are light enough, and this reaction can occur at a high enough rate. Or they can annihilate into W bosons via Chargino exchange. This is especially large if these guys have a substantial Higgino component. Or they could annihilate through a Higgs or a Z boson resonance into, for instance, B bar pairs. That's called resonance annihilation. Twice the neutralino mass is equal to one of these Higgs masses, then you'd have an enhanced annihilation rate. And here's some co-annihilation processes. Neutralino tau can annihilate into a tau and a photon. You get rid of them that way. Or you could get two taus in the early universe if they're nearby in mass, annihilating two staus, annihilating. Bar. Okay, well, you can go ahead and calculate this abundance through one of those many codes, or you can set up the code yourself, and then you can see what the results look like. And here's the M0 versus M1/2 plane in the minimal supergravity model for a value of tangent beta equal to 10. And this green region up here has omega h squared between 0.09 and 0.129. That would be consistent with WMAP. Almost all of the region here is excluded. These red regions are excluded theoretically. The white all gives you a relic abundance that is far beyond too much dark matter. So the problem up here is that superparticles get so massive, they have a very low annihilation cross-section, and you get too much dark matter produced in the early universe. There's just a teensy green region along this edge here where you get Staub full annihilation that can give you the right relic abundance. There's a teeny little region there where you can annihilate through a light Higgs pole. And then up here, there's a little bitty region where the mu parameter gets quite small and you get what's called mixed Higgsino dark matter. Then you get an enhanced annihilation rate into W and Z pairs. So most of the parameter space gets now excluded by the WMAP experiment. If you go to large tangent beta, in this case tan beta 55, I think my pointer is running out here, so I might have to just use my hands or something. Then the Higgs bosons, the heavy Higgs bosons like the A and the H, start getting quite light. And they also get very fat because the B quark Kawa coupling gets rather large. And then you can annihilate through these Higgs resonances, and then you get these broad regions where you get a good relic abundance. So in the minimal supergravity model, at least, there's some preferred regions of parameter space where you can live. A bulk region at low M0 and M1/2 where Sleptons are extremely light. This region seems to be excluded. It got eaten up by the left constraint on the Chargino, and it got pushed down into that region by the low value of the WMAP relic abundance. The Staub full annihilation region, which is a tiny region on the left side of those plots. The focus point region with at large M0 where mu got small. The A or H funnel, and then there's one region that didn't show up. For particular A values, the top squirt gets quite light and then you can annihilate the top squirt. But that's a very fine-tuned area. If you go ahead and put all these constraints, if you put the G minus 2 B to S gamma and omega H squared constraint all together as a, and do a pi squared fit, then the red areas are all excluded, and the yellow is barely allowed, and the green would be well allowed. And you can see there's almost no green regions. There's a teensy bit of green over here, some yellow here, a little bit right there, and then you go to large tan beta, you get a little bit of green here, but it's mainly yellowish. But most of the region gets excluded by the relic abundance. Yeah, well, you'd think so unless you live in one of these teensy-weensy regions over here. Yeah. So, yeah, in that respect, low tan beta would be disfavored. Large tan beta can accommodate the relic abundance much more easily through annihilation through these very fat, cave, superscalar Higgs bosons. Okay, well, if you've got these neutralinos floating around through the universe, it would be a wonderful thing if you could actually detect these particles. And remember, the neutralinos do undergo weak interaction cross-sections, so that means they will interact with quarks and leptons. And so one thing you could do is try to set up direct search experiments to look for neutralinos via neutralino-nucleon scattering. This was actually suggested by Ed Witten back in 1985. So people think that Ed Witten only does string theory. He can do great phenomenology whenever he wants to. But so if you have some sort of substrate of material with a lot of nucleons in it, then neutralinos may come in and scatter against the quark by exchanging a spark. And if they scatter elastically, these neutralinos nowadays would be floating around with rather low velocities, a few hundred kilometers per second typically. They would cause an ionization. They deposit a few keV of energy in a detector, which would be enough to ionize the atoms and send photons circulating through crystals, for instance. So there's a variety of experiments that are set up to look for these things. The neutralinos could annihilate through or scatter through diagrams like this, or via Higgs exchange, or they can even interact with gluons through loop diagrams. For instance, if the gluons resolve into a Tt bar loop, then the T quarks have large couplings with Higgs bosons, and the neutralinos can scatter from that way, or through top spore loops with the big power couplings. So these are ways these neutralinos could interact with nuclei. So a variety of experiments have been set up to search for these things. I divide them into stage one, stage two, and stage three. Stage one are already completed experiments. CDMS-1 was operating at Stanford. Edelweiss, Zeppelin 1, there's a lot more I could have written down here. Dama actually found something that looked like a signal, but the other experiments excluded. Usually what these experiments do, these ones up here use superconducting, they use crystals that are cooled down to exceedingly low temperatures. And then if the neutralino comes in, it gives an ionization signal, but also a phonon signal that can be detected propagating through these crystals. And so what the groups do is, so far these guys haven't seen any signal, and so they make a exclusion region. Unfortunately, these labels are very tiny. This is a mass of a neutralino ranging from 10 to 710 GeV. This is the cross section in picobarns. And the stage one excludes everything above this black line here. Now in supersymmetry, if you scan over a minimal supergravity model, all these dots here give you points that give you the relic abundance of around 0.11. So these would be some smattering of the points that you'd expect to see. And now stage two is now experiments that are now functioning. So CDMS-2 has moved to a mine up in northern Minnesota so that they get deep underground and away from cosmic rays. And they've pushed down to the 10 to the minus 7 picobarn level, and their aim is to go down to 10 to the minus 8 picobarns, which would put them along this dashed line here. And you can see now they're going to start excluding some real models. This is for negative mu, and this is for positive mu. So they will be sensitive, possibly, to discover or exclude some of these cases here. After CDMS-2 in the next year or two gets these results out along with other experiments, then the plan is CDMS wants to go to what's called super CDMS, which would be a 40 kilogram detector, which is going to move to the Snow Lab in Ontario, which is even deeper underground, and they have to get to extremely low backgrounds. The other experiments, Zeppelin 4 and Xenon, these are noble gas experiments that take, their aim is to take huge vats of liquid xenon, and then the neutralinos will come and interact there and leave a scintillating light signal in the ionized atoms. And then you put photo tubes around there and detect them that way. Or the clean experiment would be use either liquid argon or liquid neon to look for these types of events. There the hope is to get down to the 10 to the minus 9 picobarn level, or 10 to the minus 10 even. And those are actually quite nice levels to get down to, because you can see along here there's a band of cross sections that spread out here. It's labeled the hyperbolic branch or focus point region. This is the region where you get mixed peak xenodark matter, and all the models of mixed peak xenodark matter have cross sections for nucleon scattering around 10 to the minus 9 picobarn, and that's within shot of super CDMS and other variables. Okay. Well, there's more ways than directly detecting these nucleinos. There's indirect detection experiments as well. And one of these is an experiment at the South Pole. So at the South Pole, what a group called Ice Cube is doing, it's the successor of Amanda, is they're drilling holes deep into the ice and lowering strings of phototubes down there into a 1 cubic kilometer array. Then what they're called is a neutrino telescope, because if there's neutrinos coming from outer space, they could come and hit a atom in the ice and convert into a muon, and then the muon can propagate through this ice, which is very clear, and give off light, which can be detected by these phototube arrays. Now, for neutralinos, normally you wouldn't think you could detect them with such a detector, but as the sun sweeps through the galaxy, it's going to actually act as a vacuum cleaner, sweeping up neutralinos, because the neutralinos can interact with the atoms in the sun, and then they fall below their escape velocity, and ultimately they collect at a high density in the core of the sun. Since these are Majorana particles, they won't just sit there, but they can annihilate one with another in the core of the sun, and they're going to generally annihilate the standard model particles. For instance, neutralino goes to BD bar. Most of the standard model particles will be absorbed by the sun, but the neutrinos, especially the muon neutrinos, will propagate out, and they can be detected at the ice cube detector. It turns out that the rate for seeing these things is actually, it mainly depends on the ability of the sun to sweep up these neutralinos, and that depends on the neutralino-nucleon scattering cross-section more than on the neutralino-nucleino annihilation cross-section. So whenever you've got a big neutralino-nucleon cross-section, like in that mixed xenodark matter region, that's where the sun would be able to sweep these up at a large rate so they can annihilate the core of the sun. Now there's more ways to detect these things in indirect detection experiments. Let me go to this slide here. You could have neutralinos, of course, floating around the galactic halo in outer space, and then they can still annihilate one with the other occasionally. And in this case, if they annihilate to a W boson, which turns into a PQ bar pair, the Q bar could hadronize and turn into a P bar or an anti-deuteron. These things would be very stable, so they'd propagate through the galaxy. And if you set up a antimatter detector, say in outer space, then you might detect these antimatter particles coming from somewhere. And it might be due to dark matter annihilation of the galactic halo. Or they could annihilate to make high zeros, pi zero to beta gamma gamma, so then you can detect the gammas. The gammas propagate a long way. If you make a P bar or a D bar, these things will propagate and they get bent by magnetic fields, so they don't point to a source. The gammas are undeterred by any magnetic field, so you might get a good gamma signal from the galactic center where these neutralinos again can collect at high densities and then annihilate at high rates. So the galactic center is a good place to look for gamma rays, possibly, from neutralino annihilation. Or the neutralinos could annihilate into positrons, and you can look for positrons that way. So there's a bevy of experiments being mounted. The GLAST experiment is going to be a space-based gamma ray telescope that can look for these sorts of things. Camoa is a satellite that's been launched by Italy, and they do antimatter searches for E pluses and E bars. And then there is a GAPS experiment, which is a gaseous antiparticle spectrometer that can look for anti-deuterons by capturing the anti-deuterons and then as the into a mesic atom, and then as the atom goes to lower energy levels, they look for the X-rays after these anti-deuterons capture. And so this thing, which is being built, would be probably mounted on a balloon or possibly sent to space. Okay, well, when are the rates for these things big? If you want to calculate the rates for gammas, E pluses, E bars, etc., it depends on what sort of the rates you get depend a lot on the galactic halo profile that you look at. So, for instance, here's four different profiles. There's a dark Suzy default isothermal profile by this black line. Vero Frank White is the red one. Moore profile is the green one. Kravitzoff is the blue one. Out here where we live in the galactic halo, we're pretty confident what the density is, around 0.3 GeV per cubic centimeter. But when you get over here to low R, this is at the galactic center, you can see these models deviate wildly. And so, this just reflects the fact that we don't really have any idea what the dark matter distribution would look like in the galactic center. Well, now, once you know a galactic halo model, you can make predictions. This is a plot for the photon flux from the galactic center. Actually, this is a cut at large tan beta through that M0 M1/2 plane, which cuts through the A annihilation resonance and into the focus point region. So the bottom scale here is M0. Over on this side, you'd be in the Stahl annihilation region. As you cut through the A resonance, that gives you the good relative abundance. Well, if you're annihilating through the A resonance in the early universe, that means the A resonance is right up to nice mass, so that neutralinos and galactic halos can also annihilate through that resonance. And so if you get the right relative abundance, you also get a big jump in the indirect detection rate from galactic halo annihilation. So you can see the peak here. Then you get out of the resonance, you get to a dip until you get over to the focus point region where you get mixed big xenodark matter, and then again you get big rates again. Now this is for photons from the galactic center, and these things have huge ranges over the predictions. They range from over a couple orders of magnitude, mainly reflecting the fact that you don't know what the halo density is. If you look for, instead, positrons or antiprotons, the predictions are more certain because positrons would have to originate relatively close to Earth in the galactic halo because otherwise they would propagate and lose energy. So we know that their rates would be a little bit better. Now there's a final way that you can detect dark matter, and that is if you make it a collider experiment. So the CERN LHC is going to turn on next year, and that can also look for Suzy particles, but it also looks for the missing energy in the Suzy particle events, which you could say is probably the dark matter. Now here's the same M0 versus M1/2 plane. The red is excluded again by theory. The green region is allowed by WMAP. So you got this little style region here, and then the focus point region here. And the reach of the LHC is right here. You can see Suzy particles for all the points under here with 100 inverse femtobarns. And you can see the LHC should cover the whole style co-annihilation region, but only a fraction of this region of mixed pink xenodark matter. Out here you get Suzy particles that are extremely heavy, so the LHC can't detect them. But the mu parameter gets quite light, so Chardinos get quite light. And linear collider reach is also shown. Here's a 500 GeV linear collider. 2000 GV linear collider, they actually have a large reach up here because they can see Chargino pairs. Chargino pairs are hard to see at the LHC, so the LHC can't see up there. And then the Tevatron reach is way down here. So some of these regions of allowed dark matter can be seen by LHC, and some are not seen. If you go to large tangent beta, then that A annihilation funnel crops in. This is for tan beta 45. But again, the LHC can pretty much cover the whole A annihilation funnel. This is for 100 inverse stencil Barnes of integrated luminosity. If you go to 200 or 300 inverse stencil Barnes, then it covers up that whole thing. So the LHC stands a good chance of discovering supersymmetry, and if you see missing energy, you may well conjecture that that's due to dark matter flying out of your detector. Now it turns out you can also calculate those direct detection rates and the indirect detection rates and put them all on the same plot. So this is the same plot as before, M0 versus M1/2, with the LHC linear collider reach. The DD here is the direct detection reach of the stage 3 detectors that go down to 10 to the minus 9 picobarns. And you can see direct detection can see everything under the black curve here, which is this region of low spark masses or the region of mixed big xeno dark matter. And in fact, it covers up the whole area where it's most difficult for the LHC to see supersymmetry. So in this type of scenario, if somehow supersymmetry lived up here, the LHC wouldn't see a signal at all. But if you build these one-ton detectors for detecting dark matter, then you would still see a signal that way. The purple region denoted by the mu is what the muon telescopes, muon neutrino telescopes can do. And again, they do good in the mixed big xeno region, which is exactly where the LHC has most trouble. The ice cube detector will be fully deployed by around 2011, and so it might be seeing signals in this type of annihilation. If you go to a large tangent beta, then these reach contours go up the A annihilation funnel for the positrons or P bars or gammas. And so you can see that this is for the most pessimistic halo model. If you go to a more optimistic one, it fills up the whole A annihilation funnel. Okay, so that covers neutralinos in minimal supergravity models. There's also a possibility of what are called super wimps in supersymmetry, which would be the gravitino or the graviton in universal extra dimension models. The first excited Fine state of the graviton. So these models have been looked at a lot by Feng et al.'s group and Ellis et al.'s group. The basic idea here is that the gravitino mass is given by the scale of supersymmetry breaking, which is some mass squared divided by the Planck scale. And so it's of order of the TV and supergravity models. And usually people assume it just decouples. It has gravitational interaction, so you never know about it. However, it could be that if the gravitino is 100 GeV and the neutralino is 200 GeV or something like that, then you could produce the neutralinos via the usual method of producing thermal relics, but then the neutralinos might have a very long lifetime to decay. Ultimately, they can decay into the gravitino with these suppressed gravitational rates, but their lifetime would be extremely long, like 10 to the 4 to 10 to the 8 seconds or something like that. And so you could make these neutralinos in the early universe, and after a long time, they would decay away into the gravitinos. And then you'd get a relic abundance. Your relic abundance would be the neutralino relic abundance multiplied by the gravitino mass over the neutralino mass. Now, there's one problem. Is that the model of Big Bang nucleosynthesis predicts the abundance of elements very well. And if you have this big energy release at late times in the early universe, it could destroy these nuclei and destroy the predictions of Big Bang nucleosynthesis. So these are constraints, but they only constrain portions of these regions. So in these types of signals, in these types of regions, the collider signatures might look quite similar at the LHC, because the neutralinos would still fly out, and they wouldn't decay until much later. But you'd never detect any dark matter particles via direct or indirect detection, because they would be all these superwinds with exceedingly low cross-section. But they do give rise to unique collider signatures. For instance, instead of having a neutralino be the next white SUVI particle, you could have something like a Stau being the next white SUVI particle. And they would get produced in the early universe, but they would decay away into the gravitino. That would mean that if you made SUVI at colliders, all the SUVI particles would decay to the lightest, next lightest SUVI particle, like a Stau. And then you'd get these heavy particles shooting out of your detector, which you could see as highly ionizing cracks. As a matter of fact, there are even proposals that you could put big tanks of water around your detector, and as these Staus would come out, they would lose energy, and then they would finally come to rest in your water tank. You could collect these things, and this is a method of thing called slepton trapping. And then you could take this water and then monitor it, because the Staus would ultimately decay, and then you could look at their, watch their decays in your bedroom or something like that. Okay, so that's what you get with superwinds. Now I want to say a few words about models, supersymmetric models with non-universality. So this would go beyond the minimal supergravity model. There's because we saw a minimal supergravity model, at least for low tan beta, almost all the model was excluded. If you go to other models with non-universality, then other good things can happen. One of them is called a model with a normal scalar mass hierarchy, or an NMH model. In this type of model, the first two generations of scalars might have a similar mass, but it could be quite light. And the third generation of scalars would be quite heavy. This is actually motivated by experiment, because beta S gamma proceeds via top sport loops in its decay process, and it agrees quite well with the standard model. So you'd like the third generation scalars to be quite heavy, beyond a PEV. However, G minus 2 anomaly likes light muons, and so you'd like to have the second generation be quite light. If you take the second generation of scalars quite light, then you better have them nearly degenerate the first generation scalars, because there are strict bounds for flavor changing neutral currents that are preserved if you have near degeneracy amongst the first and second generation spectrum. So here's a plot. If you take the first and second generation scalars at 100 GeV, third generation at 1,000 GeV, then you get neutralinos that can annihilate through slepton co-annihilation and through bulk annihilation. You get big green allowed regions that can occur, and the consequence of colliders is that you get light sleptons, light electrons, and smuons, which give you lots of leptonic signatures at the collider. Now, there's other possible ways to have non-universal scalars, especially in models with non-universal Higgs masses. For instance, SO10, SUVI gut models that I talked about last time, the Higgses live in a 10-dimensional representation, while matter scalars live in a 16-dimensional representation. You might think, well, maybe the Higgses have a different mass in the gut scale than the matter scalars. And that helps you for dark matter. For instance, if I take both Higgs's equal to m phi squared, their squared mass equal to m phi squared, which is not equal to m zero, and then I pull m phi squared up in mass, well, here's a case for m zero equal to 300, m one half equal to 300. If I take m phi over m zero equal to 1, I'm in minimal supergravity and I'd be excluded here. This is omega h squared equal to 1, so you'd be excluded. As you take m phi up, the relic density falls because the mu parameter falls, and you get mixed xeno dark matter without being in the focus point region. Or likewise, you can take this m-phi squared to negative values. That's okay, as long as you minimize the scalar potential properly. And when you take it to negative values, the pseudoscalar Higgs mass drops to low values, even if you're not at large tangent beta, and the neutralino is going to annihilate through that de-annihilation funnel. So this is two different ways you can accommodate the relic density with your ordinary super parameters by taking the Higgs squared masses, either quite large or large and negative. This gives distinct collider signatures too, because in one case you get all sorts of light neutralinos over here, and in the other case you get light Higgs bosons, light pseudoscalars, and heavy Higgs, light being around 200 to 300 GeV. You can also take these Higgs squared masses to be not equal to each other, and that's motivated by SU5 Suzy guts. In SU5 Suzy guts, HU hat can live in a 5, and HD hat can live in a 5 bar, so then they could have both different masses at the gut scale. If you do that, then you can actually trade via electroweak symmetry breaking condition these two Higgs masses for the mu parameter in MA, and you can use mu and MA as free parameters, and then you can dial them to get the right dark matter, and you can plot the dark matter in the MA versus mu plane. Take mu small, you get mixed Higgsino dark matter. If you take A small, you get A annihilation dark matter. And you actually get another case. There's an S term in the RGEs that gets large. You have big Higgs splittings here. And that drives these two of the squarks to be quite light. And you can get a region with light squark annihilation, co-annihilation. So that's what can happen if you've got non-universal scalar masses. Now you can also imagine a scenario with non-universal Gugino masses. So far I've been talking about the Gugino masses. There's an M1 for the U1 Gugino mass, M2 for the SU2 Gugino mass, and M3 for the SU3 Gugino mass. These things are all equal at the gut scale and minimal supergravity models. But there's a wide variety of string models and more complicated Suzy gut models where these things have quite different values. And so you could imagine using this to get the right relic abundance. For instance, if I again go take a point that's excluded in minimal supergravity, M0 equals 300 and 1/2 equals 300, and I plot versus Gugino mass M1, for M1 equals 300, I'd be in minimal supergravity, and omega h squared would give me 1 again, which is excluded. If I pull M1 up in mass, so I break the universality, M1 will get close to M2, and then the Weino and the Beano both mix to give you what's called mixed Weino dark matter. And mixed Weino dark matter has a much higher annihilation rate. And so you can match the WMAP relic abundance here. But if you get mixed Weino dark matter, here's the Beano component of the neutralino, and here's the Weino component. See, they get about mixed up so that they're about equal. Then the mixed Weino dark matter gives you unique collider signatures too. You get certain rare decays, like decays into neutralino plus photon turning on, that are quite unique at colliders. The other thing you could do is take M1 to be smaller. If you take M1 even smaller, it'll run through the Z resonance and the Higgs resonance, and then you can take it to be negative values. Negative values are allowed. They just mean that you have to absorb a phase in your Lagrangian. And then when you get over here to negative values that are close to M2, then the neutralino stays a pure Beano, and the Chargino stays a pure Chargino, but they can get very close in mass. Then you get Chargino-neutralino co-annihilation, or what's called Beano-Weino co-annihilation. So there you get, again, a different annihilation mechanism that can match up with the WMAP abundance. this would predict that you get a very small mass gap of order 20 to 30 dB between the Chargino and the Neutralino, which is much smaller than what you normally expect in mineral supergravity models. So you get a distinctive mass gap in these types of models. Now a third thing you can do with the Gaugino masses is imagine that M1 and M2 are similar in range, and take the SU3 Gaugino mass, M3, and pull it down in value. This actually occurs in some stringy type models called mixed moduli AMSB models. In this case, what happens, I can plot the relic abundance omega h squared versus M3, and again, if I take M3 equal to 300 dB, I'm in M-sugra, and I'm excluded. As I pull M3 down in value at the gut scale, M3 pulling it down gives you a lighter galeno mass and lighter squark masses. Now, those light galenos and light squarks feed into the renormalization group equations and make the Higgs masses run not to as low values as before, because all these superparticles are coupled. And you end up getting a low mu parameter to get mixed Higgsino dark matter due to non-universal Gaugino masses. So here's the relic abundance. You see it, M3 gets down to around 150 dB. Then you again get the right relic abundance, and the Higgsino component of the neutralino increases until you get mixed Higgsino dark matter. So in this case, you'd expect relatively light galenos and squarks compared to Chargino's and neutralinos in your collider events. So you'd get rather unique spectra at the LHC or a linear collider that would reflect this mechanism that you've done to get the right dark matter abundance. Also, taking the squark and galeno mass is quite light enhances the annihilation rate. You get enhanced neutralino scattering rates and annihilation rates, not only because you get mixed Higgsino dark matter, but also the squark masses come down, and that gives you double enhancement. And so you're very likely to see direct and indirect detection signals this way. Now, a final way you can also get the right relic abundance is to go to direct supergravity models beyond the MSSM. And the one that has some motivation is called the NMSSM, or next to minimal supersymmetric standard model. Remember, gauge coupling unification likes the MSSM because they have just the right data function to get gauge coupling unification. But if you add an extra gauge singlet field S hat, it doesn't have any gauge quantum numbers, it won't affect that running. You still have the gauge coupling unification, but these types of models where you add an extra singlet, the extra singlet could be around the TV scale, and it actually helps solve something called the mu problem in supersymmetric models. But it also gives rise to conditional particles. If I can get my pointer to work here, instead of getting the usual 5 Higgs bosons, you get 3 neutral scalar Higgses, 2 pseudoscalars, and then you get 5 neutralinos instead of 4. And then several other parameters enter into the model. And the extra parameters, of course, give you extra freedom to try to match up the relic abundance right. And Belanger et al. Have computed the relic abundance in the NMSSM and show regions where you fulfill the WMAP relic abundance with this model, which has some extra parameter freedom. So that leads me to the end of this talk. As conclusions, there's an overwhelming evidence for cold dark matter in the universe. Numerous candidates are available for cold dark matter particles. Axions are very intriguing. There's ongoing searches. ADMX group is looking for microwaves. There's a Japanese group using Rydberg atoms looking for these things. SUSY, lightest supersymmetric particle, is very intriguing, because it would be a thermal relic. That is, it has exactly the right cross-section to produce the right relic abundance order of magnitude-wise. from the Big Bang. And there's various allowed regions that give rise to distinct collider and dark matter signatures. There's direct and indirect detection, dark matter detection prospects. There's detection at colliders. I'm going to say more about this tomorrow for the LHC case. Or you could have super WIMPs, which would give you no direct or indirect detection signals that you shouldn't see in a collider. And then if you are worried that minimal supergravity model is mainly excluded, if you go to models with non-universal scalars or non-universal Gaugino masses or additional gauge singlets, then it's all much more easy to accommodate the omega h squared bound from the W. No, they won't affect the neutrino oscillation. These neutrinos, these muon neutrinos from dark matter annihilation,
are going to be
extremely energetic.
Yeah, I know that. I know about the neutrino problem. It established from the standard standard system model. So maybe it's one of the pragmatic effects. So I think no, if pragmatic effect is included, if can impact the neutrino problem.
Yeah, I think that's
right.
I think
that's
right.
Okay, let's start this paper again. This afternoon, we will get to Yunji Temple. So please, at 1:30 p.m., we will getting bus in front of a whole building, and we prepare the water, so you needn't prepare the water. And tomorrow morning we will check up, so please take your luggage to conference room 6 and give us your room key. Okay, tomorrow morning. Thank you.
明天早上把那个房间钥匙给我们。 然后把大家行李放在6号会议室，好吧？ 下午是5点钟，然后从那儿返回，大家5点钟准时那个发车，注意一下。